This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Happy today because we are on YouTube. So if you are looking for us, you can find us right here on YouTube on Tan Talk Radio. So it's really fantastic. And this is just such a wonderful opportunity for me to also just say to everyone, I hope that you are remembering everyone who suffered in Northern Florida with the hurricane and donating generously to Red Cross, because it's really important that we help these people at this time of the year. Now, when the weather's cooling down and on top of everything, it gets cold up in the panhandle, so you never know what's going to hit them. Anyway, I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper today, which is a program for writers and those who dream of writing, somebody that every writer needs, an intellectual property lawyer. So I'm happy to welcome Bill Larson, of Larson & Larson. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Well, you are our legal eagle, and I want to tell everyone, and I want to remind my listeners already know, and all of the new listeners, because since BoucherCon was here, the convention for mystery writers was here in St. Petersburg, I have just gotten so many more listeners, especially writers who want to know more about how they should get published and then how they should protect themselves. And I want to remind everyone that Bill is a member of the American Intellectual Property Law Association. This is very important. You do not want, when you are protecting something as valuable as your intellectual property, you do not want to use your real estate lawyer, your family lawyer, or your sister-in-law who just passed the bar exam, right?
Correct.
You want an expert.
Correct.
And you are. And your law firm keeps getting all sorts of awards, and it's fantastic.
It's been very good lately.
And you've expanded. You were originally just here in St. Petersburg area. Now you have a Tampa office.
Yes.
It's keeping you busy, huh?
We're very busy.
That's great. Well, I should also add that Bill is also my patent lawyer. So if any of you have a patent idea, and before you go on Shark Tank, you better see Bill, because he knows what he's doing when it comes to getting patents. So be careful out there. Now, Bill, it's funny. The other day I had on the program Lisa Gabriel, who wrote a book called The Winters, and it is based on the very famous book Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. And now she's just paying a sort of homage to Rebecca, which many people, of course, have seen the film, which was very, very popular film. And the book, of course, came out in 1938 and sold over 3 million copies. So it's a very popular book, too. But I, in researching that, I discovered that she was accused of plagiarism.
Way back then.
Way back then. I don't know when the first case of plagiarism ever... Is there... Somebody knows the first case ever filed?
It is probably thousands of years ago.
Everybody's been ripping off everybody for all these years. Human nature is the same. But in this case, this was a very serious case, because this was a very popular book turned into a film, a very popular film at the time. And, wow.
And the law was a lot different way back then. The Copyright Act has gone through a number of changes over the years, particularly as a result of the changes in the way works are published, now almost entirely electronic. And so back in this day, when you could only publish by paper or by film, right, the way you protected your copyrights was a lot different.
Now, the woman who accused du Maurier of plagiarism, her name, what's her name? Oh, I just had it. Okay. Carolina, I'm sorry. Carolina Nabucco. I should know that because I know her father's work. Now, Carolina was from Brazil, but lived in Paris, and she had written a book, and she claimed that du Maurier stole this, actually the entire story from her.
That's what she claimed, yes.
And because they had a relationship with this sort of in the same area of publishing, so that their publishers knew her publishers and her agents knew her.
Ran in the same circle.
So she claimed that Rebecca was an actual ripoff of her story.
And claimed that she copied and plagiarized the main plot. And some of the situations and dialogues between the persons. But it doesn't look like it really went anywhere.
Well, it didn't go anywhere. But the funny thing is, the book is called A Sucessora, which is in Portuguese, of course. And it
successor.
The successor. And it's available actually on Amazon. So anybody who reads Portuguese can read it and tell me how much of it is, because, you know, that's long ago and nobody actually wrote the details of what the similarities were. But the interesting thing in this is that when the movie came out, the movie people went to her. They went to Carolina and asked her to sign a release. So they must have suspected that she had some rights in there.
Yeah, so they were trying to, you know, cover their butt, make sure. So not always is there a plagiarism, but a lot of times I have clients that will seek permission, even though they don't think it's a problem, just to be on the safe side and share revenues. It's a safe business decision sometimes. It's not an admission that you're doing anything wrong or you copied. Sometimes it's just a safe business decision.
Now, in this case, of course, I don't know if she actually ever landed up signing it, but it – you know, having written it in Portuguese, she didn't have as much power in England or in America at the
courts were not as sophisticated back then, and there was not as many attorneys around then who practiced this area of law. So it was a very niche business. You can understand how an author almost 100 years ago would not be interested in getting into a legal battle internationally.
Yeah, in those days, of course, would have been a very difficult process.
A very slow process.
And it's not easy today because
no typewriters, nothing.
I mentioned to you last time you were here about an Australian children's author whose books someone has taken and translated them word for word into all sorts of languages. That, like Uzbekistan, in Albania, and all sorts of countries.
And there's no real way to
stop
it.
And there's no way she can stop it.
Nope.
And the
result of the digital age.
Exactly. In that case, it's not just her words, also her drawings, because she illustrated the book herself.
It's not unusual that when there is a knockoff, they take everything. They leave nothing behind.
That happens. So the question is, couple of things. How do you protect yourself? One, first, in the case of when you're writing a book that's based on another book, how is there any problem with that?
Yes, if one book's based on an earlier book by a different author, then permission is required because the second work is known as a derivative work.
Okay, although, for example, in this case, Lisa Gabriel changed. She actually used a lot of the names are, you know, just a little bit changed. And she added some characters and took away some characters.
It's a subjective decision-making process. It goes case by case. And you have to separate the concepts from the subjective and determine whether, you know, just that particular plot is routine, you know, or whether the minutia of the characters or the dialogues or the plot are so similar that one copied the other, and if so, then it's an infringement.
Well, in this case, of course, Rebecca is such a famous novel, and the rights are copyright issues are referred to Curtis Brown. So, and Curtis
the more
Brown
famous,
big,
the more likely
big.
It's a
yeah.
You know,
so, if in that case, it would be easy to find and contact the owners of the copyright, and I don't know if you would
In most cases, it's very difficult to get somebody to admit that they copied. And so the only way you can determine whether there's an infringement is the second part of the test is substantial similarity. And that's difficult.
Hmm.
If somebody admitted to copying, then that's pretty much the end of the case, right? You lose, you infringe. But no one ever admits that. They say, no, these are just coincidences. It's just the same type of plot. And so then you have to prove substantial similarities, and that is the difficult part, because you can find typical themes in other works, which you could say, well, I got an idea from over here, but not from your particular work.
And
very
so
hard to prove.
Then you're protected. But in general, if you want to find out nowadays, of course, it's easier. I wanted to see who owned the copyright for Rebecca, and I discovered it was Curtis Brown. All I had to do was type in who owns the copyright.
Right. You can search it very easily. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Library of Congress or the Copyright Office, it's very easy to search these things now.
And so then all you would have to do is contact them if if you thought that you... that you should, and if you
and they have now the sophisticated software which compares works.
Yes,
and they use algorithms to determine the mathematical likelihood of whether it's a coincidence or a copy.
Yes, that's the one we talked about before. The librarian who was taking romance novels and then copying them word for word. I mean, she didn't change anything except the names. She did a search and replace. Like, it's easy on Word. You do a search, replace. She replaced the names, changed the names. And the only thing she added was at the end of, like, every other chapter, she'd add a sex scene. Completely superfluous.
Right. So the addition of work doesn't negate the fact that it's an infringement. And so plagiarism is a big problem right now. It's easy to do electronically, but it's also easy to discover electronically. For instance, universities now use anti-plagiarism software. So when students submit their works, they run it through the software to see if it's been copied from somewhere else on the internet, and if so, then it's rejected. So they're, forcing the students to
actually
write their own work.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Oh, Bill, I mean, wow. Oh, you poor students out there, you actually have to think for yourself and come.
God forbid.
Oh, my goodness. It's difficult, I know. But, yes, you can't copy from Wikipedia paragraphs anymore.
Don't copy, because they will know.
They will know.
All universities now will test your works and your thesis to make sure that you did not plagiarize.
Okay, everybody out there, make sure that you think and
start from scratch.
Start from scratch. Now, in the case of, when they wanted this release from the Brazilian author, of course, she at the time, I don't think she signed it. And
no, she
as
did
you
not.
Said, she didn't continue
it's
it.
It's not clear
but
why.
But Demir, Dame Daphne, because she was, given a title in England, was also accused of stealing the birds, which is another very famous story.
Story and movie that came out in the 60s. Yeah,
exactly. Very famous. And again, in that case,
Nothing happened.
Nothing happened. So I don't know if it's a...
Sometimes authors just don't want to get into the hardships of litigation. Because it's difficult.
It's expensive.
It's expensive. It's confusing. It's uncertain. It's aggravating. And a lot of people just don't want to get into it, and I respect that.
Yeah, well, and of course, unless you do have a sister-in-law who's passed the bar exam and will do all the work free, everything is expensive.
You
got
to have a tough skin to survive litigation.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that from representing many, many clients over the years. There are those who can handle it, and there are those who cannot. And so you have to be cut from a certain cloth to handle long-term litigation, particularly in the federal court system.
Now, to avoid a lot of problems, what are your recommendations to authors to make sure that they safeguard their intellectual property?
Okay, so it starts from scratch. Whenever you create a work, whether you're working on a patent or an idea or a book or anything, you want to every day initial and date your work, and you want to lock it up somewhere safe, okay, where it can't be seen by anybody. So a locked drawer or a cabinet, somewhere no one has access. And as you continue on your work, make sure you always initial and date that. And so that makes a very clear record, and it's evidence that the courts love to show creation. And then when you get to the point where you believe it's done, either your invention for your patent or your work if you're an author, then you're going to see a lawyer, and you're going to get registered. Okay, and so the process of registration for patents and copyrights is submitting it to the government, the government's approving it, you're paying the government some money, and you get a piece of paper back, which is a grant, really. It's a right. The government's giving you rights, and that right is to exclude others from using the invention or copying the work that you made. All right, so that's the initial thing that the authors, inventors need to do. You also want to be very careful with anybody that you contract with. So we always want to have contracts in writing, and we want to make sure that intellectual property attorneys write those contracts, because there's a lot of magic words in there, and if the magic words aren't in there, a contract could not be enforceable.
And your average real estate lawyer does not know. I mean,
you need
might
to go
be
to a specialist. Exactly. You really need an IP specialist, because these contracts are very specific. The law is ever-changing. The pendulum is always swinging. And so you need a lawyer who's keeping up to date on the law as it changes, so that your contract is going to be enforceable. God forbid you have to go to court and argue it in front of a judge.
Now, one of the things that is happening in this industry, there are a lot of scams out there. And one of the things I have heard from so many authors, they are getting emails from Hollywood, always from Hollywood, from Beverly Hills. They're always from Beverly Hills. And they are saying, send us your book, and we will read it, and we will see if it will just make a wonderful movie, and we'd just love to advise you on it.
Be very careful about that, yeah. And, you know, there's ways to vet those out, okay? Either delete them if they're obviously frauds or scams, but also, you know, you can do your own independent research on the internet to vet out these scams and find out if they're real or not.
Well, I really want to tell everybody, 99% of them are scams. I have done a lot of the work for you. And in a recent case where somebody was going to send in some material, I not only went to Google Earth to check out where their office was, which was very nice, it was the second floor of a bodega, and I checked out the people who claimed that they were Hollywood experts, and they had over 100 years of experience in Hollywood, but they were all extras in films, or they were the girls who did the flowers on the
overstated
set.
Overstated or embellished their career, exactly.
Yes. And so you do not want to send, and in many cases, they are asking for the entire book.
A big part of what I do in my practice is what we call due diligence, okay? And that's where we do a very deep analysis of persons or companies that we're dealing with.
And this is vital.
Make sure that they're for real.
Exactly. Because, and even if somebody's famous, you don't want to send your book to them. Because I hate to tell you this, but I
once
can tell
out,
you from
it's
experience.
Out. It's gone.
It's gone.
In the digital world. It's gone. It can be replicated a million times in a matter of seconds.
Yes.
You have to be very careful about that.
So that's why, really, it's such a...
And a lawyer can guide you through that, or an agent.
Absolutely.
Don't just do it yourself. You know, get a professional to help you if you're a young author. Get a lawyer, get an agent, and they'll help protect you from being scammed.
And speaking of agents, it reminds me of a question that one of my listeners wrote in, and she mentioned that Midnight Inc. is closing down. Now, Midnight Inc. has a big stable of mystery writers, and it's a shame that they're closing down. But life is difficult in the publishing world, and you have to really be strong out there. And there's a lot of competition.
And the margins are very thin to make money now these days in this area.
Exactly.
And so it's tough to make a buck.
And so, but of course, there are, as I said, many people who have been with Midnight Inc. for many years.
Mm-hmm. So now what happens?
Exactly. What happens?
Well, there's probably some kind of an agreement between the publisher and the author as to the terms of the sale of the work. And so that has to be carefully considered by a lawyer to see what the rights are. I haven't specifically looked at that contract for that company, but if somebody came to me with that question, the first thing I would do is to get that contract and read that contract to find out what happens in the event that the company goes out of business. One of the other things that you have to take into consideration is bankruptcy, because if bankruptcy is involved, then the bankruptcy trustee can take over all of those contracts and determine whether to rip them up or keep them in force. You can actually lose rights that way. And so when dealing with publishers, it's also it's very important in the contracts we write is to have provisions in for what happens in the case of bankruptcies.
Oh, that's something I never even thought about.
Mm-hmm, because the bankruptcy courts have the right to
they
take
own
the
it.
Rights. They own it, yeah, basically.
Which I think is one of the we do have. I do have a friend who's an author who's been trying for 20 years to get her rights back, and I think they probably went into bankruptcy.
If they get caught up in bankruptcy, it can be a long process, and you can lose your rights, and it's terrible.
It's terrible, and you never know. You write a book today, and maybe it's not a bestseller. But somebody comes along 10 years later, and this happens in Hollywood a lot, that suddenly, I don't know, they're stuck somewhere.
Well, times change, and then people...
And they say, whoa, that'd make a good movie.
Yeah.
But if, oh my goodness, you would just want to kill yourself if a bankruptcy court owned your rights.
Right. So the first thing to do is take a look at whatever agreement you signed with this company concerning your publishing. And find out if they're having any kind of a program where they're going to have an announcement concerning their winding up or bankruptcy. If it's bankruptcy, that's a worst case scenario. If it's just a winding up, in other words, going out of business, then hopefully there will be contractual ways to
revert the
rescind the contract or terminate the contract.
Okay, this is a new thing. Who knew? There are so many things that authors have to know.
And that's why it's important that they see lawyers and have lawyers review contracts. And so at least you know what your rights are. With a lot of my clients, I say, well, this is not a good idea. They sign anyway because they'll tolerate that risk. But you need to know what it means if you're going to sign it and accept the risk of what happens. That's the important part.
Okay, Bill. Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
It's
this gives us a lot of things to think about. I am going to take part in National Novel Writing Month, and I was looking for an idea for a book, and I have decided to do this one about the plagiarism suit of Rebecca. So I'm going to spend the entire month writing 50,000-word book about this. Now, I'm announcing this on air, so if any of you steal this idea and you start writing a suspense book based on this, Bill's going to sue you for me, okay? Okay, Bill, thanks so much for being in today.
Thank you.
Okay.
My pleasure.
Okay, and we'll see you next month.
See you next
month. Okay, thanks a lot. Okay, we're going to go to commercial. Great.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
WTAN Radio is proud to announce that local author and speaker Glenn Erickson will soon be a guest on Pat Z's Joy on Paper program. He will tell you how he got his start and how you too can become an accomplished writer, author, and speaker. Glenn Erickson has published self-help books as well as speculative fiction stories and novels. All of his books are available on Smashwords.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry my pillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
My Pillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
And I am back, and I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper today, George Stone. Oh, I don't have George Stone. Just a moment. Hold on. Nat Geo. Who do I have?
You have August Turak.
I don't know. Okay. Well, we're going to have some fun today on live radio. I'm supposed to have George Stone here. We will wait a few minutes. Okay, I'm just waiting. I'm supposed to have, as far as I know, but who knows, The Journeys of a Lifetime. This is probably going to be my number one book for the year. It's called Journeys of a Lifetime, second edition by a National Geographic book, and it is 500 of the world's greatest trips. It is so beautiful. It is such a wonderful book that I am just absolutely thrilled. I've been reading it ever since I got it. It's a book that you will not want to stop reading. Reading like 3 or 4 stories every couple of hours. I stop whatever I'm doing. I just pick it up and I sit down and I can read it and just enjoy myself, because it's just such a wonderful, wonderful collection of trips. And the most amazing thing I've discovered is that I have been on, I have been on at least 50 of these trips, which is really exciting, because I've been living overseas many years. I traveled a lot, and I didn't realize until sort of you see it all in one place. And now I'm very annoyed with myself that I didn't think at the time of actually, sitting down and writing these stories myself, because I have done these trips. And when you read this book, you'll say, whoa, there are so many that you probably have done. There are ones here, right here in America, like Greenwich Village, National Mall. And of course, one of the most beautiful is the on the Appalachian Trail through Vermont. I don't know how many of you have done that, but that is a wonderful, wonderful trip. And you would just love just sitting with this book and reading it and going through all of the different stories, both the ones that are set here in America and all over the world. And of course, being National Geographic, the stories and the are just as great as the photography, because of course National Geographic has the world's greatest photographers, but they also have some of the greatest writers, because they are. It's amazing how, and this is always a talent, an author who can take and tell a story in 1 or 2 pages. And that's what they're doing here on in this wonderful, wonderful book. So I really hope that you will get it. It's at Thanksgiving, most people don't think of bringing books as gifts as when you go to a Thanksgiving dinner. Everybody's always bringing wine. And my feeling about bringing wine, I discovered this. Well, it happens with me too. People, if I'm having a dinner, I've already selected the wine. I have the wine. I know what wine goes with what. And you always feel sort of uncomfortable. Somebody brings you wine, and do you serve that wine, although that wasn't the wine that you had planned? Or do you put it on a shelf and then forget it and don't remember it until the next time they come over? And I think it's uncomfortable. Now, flowers are nice. I like flowers. But again, in general, arriving with flowers isn't as nice as if you're going to give flowers, you should send them early so that they can be set up when your guests arrive. And now, do we have George on the phone?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, George, I'm so happy. I'm so happy that you are on the phone because, well, I've been blabbing on here about journeys of a lifetime, 500 of the world's greatest trips, and I was thinking about you, George. I've been thinking about you for a couple of weeks ever since I got this book. First, George is my favorite name. I'll tell you something. I have an 8-foot giraffe named George. Yes, I do.
Oh.
Now, not many people have an 8.
That makes sense because the George actually means earth worker. That's the Greek root of it. So it's farmer, and a giraffe is like an earth muncher.
Exactly, and it's so funny. I have an 8-foot giraffe at my front door who I say hi to every time I walk in that door, and he's beautiful. And I always name my favorite things George. So I was so happy. And I've been thinking about you, and I thought, well, if there's anybody who has like the most perfect job in the world, it is George Stone. I mean, wow. You actually get paid to sit around all day looking at these photographs?
Yes, I do. So I'm editor-in-chief of National Geographic Traveler magazine and National Geographic Travel Media, and it is my job to sit around and look at beautiful pictures of the world and to think about places to go, and occasionally I get to go there myself.
That's what I was going to say. That's even worse. They make you go out there and actually see these places. Oh, what
it was painful. It's so hard. It's so much hardship in one lifetime.
Oh, my.
I cannot believe it.
Oh, my goodness. If people are, like, ever dreaming, like, a dream job, I think you have it. It's certainly better than being a politician.
Oh, my God.
What fun you have.
And not only that. With National Geographic, what we do, we use visual storytelling and storytelling in general to increase interest in connecting with the world and in telling important stories about the world and our place within it. So what we do is mission-driven, and it's been so since 1888 when National Geographic was founded. And so the privilege is to tell important stories about the world and to encourage people to get out.
And to bring us all closer together. Now, the funny thing, this is 500 of the world's greatest trips. And I've gone through the book a couple of times, and I have been on at least 50 of them. At least 50. Yes.
That's great.
Yes. And including, now, I'm going to ask you about your favorite one, but one of the favorite sections that I loved was top 10 food pilgrimages, and I have been to 7 of those places, 7 of those restaurants.
Oh, my Lord. Okay, so I can see which chapter you're most passionate about. So the book is divided into sections. Some are modes of transport, like by road, travel by road, travel by rail, but then others are area of interest, like, and this one is called In Gourmet Heaven. So so you travel with your appetite first.
Yes, and it's so funny. When I got to that, I said, 7? I've been to 7 of these out of 10. I thought that's pretty fantastic.
Well, congratulations.
Have you been to that many?
Yeah. No. You're 70% super duper awesome.
Isn't it?
So of the food pilgrimages, I'll mention a few of them so listeners can know. The book has a number of top 10 lists, and the lists are sort of curated by National Geographic travel writers and experts. And the top 10 food pilgrimages, things like going to Peter Luger Steakhouse in Brooklyn, New York, which is often considered the very best steakhouse, or the French Laundry, which is a very fancy restaurant in Napa Valley. But really things like going to New Orleans to see that amazing, you know, that Creole, that blend
Antoine's.
Of culinary tradition. And, you know, or having Sacher Torte in Vienna, in Austria, which is this layered cake, or having a big bowl of noodle soup of pho in Hanoi, Vietnam. So these are the sorts of things that that I think are not just like building blocks of a list, but these are like memory blocks in life. And it sounds like you've got like more than seven amazing food memories.
It's been so wonderful, and I lived in England for quite a few years, and so that's why I went to Europe a lot. And as a matter of fact, I lived, one of the restaurants mentioned in there is called the Fat Duck in Bray. And I lived about 20 miles from that restaurant, so I know it well.
Yeah, well, and you know, that's a good example, too, because the Fat Duck is this Heston Blumenthal, a highly regarded chef who's very playful. He changes the shape of food. So, like, everything changes in the world. Destinations change, modes of transport change. Food changes. Some is quite traditional, and that's kind of the magic of it. Say a certain tapas in Spain, little bits and bites that you eat that won't change over the decades. But there are real innovations in food and changing the format of food, the shape of food, using certain techniques of molecular gastronomy to surprise and delight diners and to challenge, you know, the idea of what food should look like or could look like. You know, is a real innovation and is a good reason to go travel.
Well, there are so many, as you said, it's broken down into chapters, into areas, and I don't know, it's hard for you to say which one is your favorite, but tell us a few of your favorite.
Well, one place I love is Namibia, and that's Southwest Africa, coastal. Got this this almost frightful shoreline called the Skeleton Coast, shipwrecks and so forth over centuries. But then inland it moves to dunes, towering, vibrating sand dunes that whistle in the wind and are loaded with life forms that you think couldn't possibly exist in an arid climate like that, but do. Beetles, you know, grasses, and then moving all the way up to antelopes, and even for you, desert giraffes. Not exactly on the dunes, but inland a little bit within the desert region. And then Namibia sort of pushes over toward Botswana, where the Okavango Delta is this vast wetland, seasonally flooded. It's a major area of conservation effort by National Geographic, and is home to huge populations of elephant and wildlife, and you can have like an amazingly green safari there, where over in Namibia you have these towering sand dunes. So it's a part of the world that's majestic and surprising.
Well, every photograph in this book is truly amazing, as always with Nat Geo, just the best photographers in the world, but also the most wonderful writers, because I'm always so thrilled when an author can just write in one page, write a story that's so evocative that you want to get on an airplane and get there.
Yeah. That's it. When the day goes well, when we do our job right, it may have that effect on people. So it's certainly what we aim for. The tools we use at National Geographic are pretty basic. We are storytellers. We use photography, video, sound, and words. And we publish stories across different formats, including TV and online and then print. And so, but the magic is is capturing moments. And some of the time, you know, the magic is about, it's actually about time. And so National Geographic is one of those few places that will send out a documentary photographer for a long stretch of time. National Geographic magazine often sends photographers, say, three times to cover a story over the course of 1 year, so that you end up with 100,000 images to choose from, and some might be very similar, but some might be quite different. And then you piece together a story that is sort of wedded visually, wedded with the narrative, and also with the theme of the story, which could be a story about conservation or innovation or a documentary story about cultures and people around the world. But it does take time to tell stories well, and so that really is one of the unique qualities that National Geographic brings to storytelling. It's not just the output in the end, but it's the time that's been invested to get there.
And I think whenever you read a Nat Geo book, recently I did the new almanac for 2019, which is absolutely fantastic, and a book like this, it makes you think that, you know, people are out there who are so similar to us, and we could all be friends. And you when you see the pictures of the people, you say, oh, you know, I would like to go there. I'd like to know the people in that area. I'd like to make friends with these people. And it's just a wonderful service, I think, that Nat Geo has done, really, as you say, for all of these years, to bring the world to our fingertips.
Well, thank you for saying that. It's, I mean, we see that as our mission. So the idea of recognizing that the world is vast and varied, but at the same time it's small and connected. And so, and certainly it's shared. And so the idea is that, you know, if we can show more people more of the world, we'll be building more connections, more genuine curiosity, so that people feel connected and engaged and actually part of what's happening around the world. So if it's something highly technical related to conservation, say stories about plastics, plastic pollution, or microplastics in the oceans or waterways, or if it's something much more personal, like within our travel stories about, you know, someone going, say, tracing their DNA and going on a heritage journey to connect with their traditional roots in Ireland, say. You know, these are important, and these are important on a personal level, and sometimes are important on a global level, but it's one thing we can do is help support these bridges.
Well, there are so many stories, it's hard to say which ones are more fascinating. I think the ones really for Americans, it really opens your eyes when you think, sometimes people will go to Greenwich Village and not think that it's that, you know, it's great, but they don't sort of envision it as one of the 500 great places to be in the world. Or how many Americans have gone to Yosemite and really appreciated that, wow, this is really a fantastic journey and a fantastic opportunity to see one of the most beautiful places in the world. So that's why I just found that so fascinating, how many places are right here in America.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that we love as well. I mean, we live on a continent, and we have two oceans, the world's greatest bodies of water on either side, and we have cars, and we have tremendous diversity culturally and geographically in this country. So it was cool just to see all the different things you can do in North America, you know, including Canada, including Mexico, experiences, Mexico's colonial cities, hot air ballooning, going to see Maya temples just to talk about Mexico, going on a Rocky Mountaineer rail journey in the Canadian Rockies. Or another example might be going to Yosemite in California in the footsteps of Ansel Adams, the great photographer, whose work was so important in inspiring a conservation effort within our wildlands and national parks in the U.S.
And I love the stories about authors. How many journeys along, you know, the way to see where the authors lived or where they traveled. It's fascinating.
Totally. Jane Austen and Bath, for instance. When you go to Bath in England, well, you've lived there, so you've been there.
Not only did I live there, I bought a 400-year-old cottage in England so that I could live near where Jane Austen lived. I was obsessed with Jane Austen, and when I was 21 years old, I bought a 400-year-old cottage there.
That's amazing. And so, what came of it? What did you learn?
I was so thrilled when I saw that was one of the tours that you had there, because it is a fantastic. Of course, for me, it was. I lived it for like 4 years. I was walking sort of in her footsteps because I was obsessed with her there. And then, of course, the next story after that is James Joyce's Dublin. And another wonderful story. That's why this book is just so, it's so much fun. And as I said, because I've been to over 50 of these places, including, by the way, and this is really funny. I have to tell you this one because not many people have done this trip in the way I did this trip. I followed in Alexander's footsteps through Turkey.
Oh, my Lord.
In a white Cadillac, a white American 19...
Wow.
Now, is
That's diva style. Yeah, in the path of greatness,
and following that same Alexander's legacy, which you have here, and you have the story of Alexander's legacy through Turkey, and not many people have done it in a white Cadillac.
How did you end up getting the Cadillac? Why was that even there?
Well, we brought it in to because we lived over there. We brought it into Germany from America, and then we drove it all the way across Europe, and including that also the Bavarian trip. So many of my trips were done in that white Cadillac. It was lots of fun.
That is the travel in style.
Exactly.
And to make your own memory And I would imagine that the things you remember fondly are just normal little things off the side of the road, whether it was eating some delicious Turkish delights or something, or just a person you saw or a Silk Road caravan.
Exactly. All of that was there, and I'm so thrilled that I did it, and I hope that people will be inspired by this book to take some of these tours. As you said, you know, so many are right here in America that you might not think of and really appreciate until you read this book and you look at the photography. And, you know, George, I think everybody should just, you know, think of you sitting there making money while you're looking at pictures. I think it's like so perfect. It's like it's better than winning the lottery because you are just having so much fun.
Well, that's true. And I try not to let my boss know on a day-to-day basis, but she would approve because she's a pretty fun person. And and I'm glad you said it because travel is supposed to be fun. The world is there, and we're a part of it. And when we go out to see it, to make connections, to make memories happen, it should be fun and rewarding.
And
that's why not everybody has to go to the same place. They should go to the place that they want to go to.
Exactly. And I never liked the term bucket list. I don't like that. I think it should be the joy list, because joy is an important word. I find joy on paper and joy in traveling. And this book is really a book for people who want to create a joy list. That's what I'm.
I love that.
Isn't that perfect?
That's a cover line.
That
yeah,
is.
I think that might be the next book.
Okay, well, yeah. I want to thank you so much, George, for being on the program today. It's the second edition of Journeys of a Lifetime, 500 of the World's Greatest Trips, and it's been edited by George Stone, who is brilliant and who has an absolutely fabulous name. And now every time I say good morning to my George, I will be thinking of the 500 trips.
Well, thank you, Patsy, and I hope that you have a new year of amazing journeys and delicious stops.
Well, thank you, and I want to tell everyone this is the book to get to give as a gift through the holidays, whether it's Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, Christmas, Happy New Year. This is the book to give to everybody.
Well, I hope, because it is inspiring, and it's all about the world and our place in it.
Okay. Well, again, thank you so much, George, for being on the program today.
Thank you. It's a privilege.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Woo! We got him. Okay. It took a minute, but my brilliant Ed in the control room, he got it all organized for me. I want to thank him so much. So remember, this is your new book that you need to do, a joy list, a list of places that you want to see. And if you can't see them, you can read about them in Journeys of a Lifetime, 500 of the World's Greatest Trips. It's available. It's so cheap. It's only $40. I mean, I cannot believe that price is... It's like a giveaway. This should be a $100 book. It's $40. You must buy it for yourself, and you must buy one for anybody that you love, because they will sit. It's really a book that you want to just keep next to you, open it up, and maybe travel, maybe get some ideas for your book that you're going to write during National Novel Writing Month in November. Go to NaNoWriMo.org and sign up. It's coming soon, November 1st. You can be a winner. All you have to do is write 50,000 words. That's 1,666 words a day. And you will be a winner. And this is the wonderful thing that I always tell you, that it's up to you. And as Mary Higgins Clark, who is going to be on the program, let's see. Oh, she's going to be November 15th with her new book, because she always comes out with a book. And she's going to be on. Make sure that you go to NaNoWriMo, sign up, and start writing your book. And you will be a very, very happy person. So remember that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them in an audible book, or to have them illustrated. So you never know, but it's up to you. And then maybe one day you'll hear those absolutely magic words, lights, camera, action, because your book is turned into a film or into a movie. And one of the things I want, or into a Hallmark series, which I think should happen to Carol J. Perry's books, Witch City Mysteries, because they are all so wonderful. She has a new book for Christmas season coming up, and it's recently was released, Bell's Spells and Murder, and it is wonderful. Another one of Carol's great mysteries, and I want to tell everyone you should get that. It's available wherever books are sold, but in Barnes & Noble, because she is very popular there. And so it's a wonderful opportunity for you to read a cozy mystery and to get some ideas on how to write a cozy mystery. Just read Carol J. Perry's series. She's into book 8 already, and she's doing a fantastic job. And again, I want to thank Glenn Erickson for supporting Joy on Paper, and Larson and Larson, my intellectual property lawyers, because they are absolutely fantastic. And of course, say something nice to somebody today. I will again say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, and I'm saluting him. He's saluting me. And thank you so much for joining me today. Bye-bye now.